Usually, when we think about solving, massive global crises, we just expect the solutions to be equally massive, like incredibly complex and probably full of bureaucratic red tape.
Oh, yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely. Endless red tape.
Right. I mean, you think about ending extreme poverty and you immediately picture thousands of NGOs, highly targeted relief programs, just endless logistical hurdles.
Yeah, totally.
And then you look at reversing climate change and you picture these massive global summits or like multi-billion-dollar carbon capture facilities. We just tend to treat the economy and the environment as if they exist in completely separate universes.
Well, and because we view them as these two distinct, incredibly complicated mountains to climb, the progress is just, it's painfully slow.
Yeah, exactly.
But to really appreciate the source material we're diving into today, we have to look at the global context that researchers are actively responding to right now. Because the COVID-19 pandemic, it just exposed these massive structural vulnerabilities in our society. I mean, virtually overnight, millions of people were plunged into poverty as supply chains froze.
Yeah, livelihoods just vanished.
Exactly. And simultaneously, we are living through this era where human activities are driving catastrophic environmental degradation, overexploitation of resources, plastic just choking the waterways, and accelerating climate change.
Which brings us to the mission for this deep dive. Because today we are exploring this massive 2024 global analysis that was published in Cell Reports Sustainability.
Yeah, and it covers a staggering 186 countries.
It's huge. And the authors propose this seemingly contradictory, almost paradoxical proposition for you to think about. Like, what if the ultimate solution to saving the environment is literally just giving people free money?
It sounds crazy at first.
It does. But they're proposing a universal basic income, unconditional regular cash disbursements,
Gas.
as this two-pronged mechanism to tackle both environmental collapse and global poverty at the exact same time.
It's a radical proposition for sure. But I mean, the data they present really forces a reevaluation of how we structure economic incentives.
Yeah.
They aren't just suggesting we hand out cash and cross our fingers. They're proposing a total systemic rewiring of global finance,
Right.
where the very mechanism that heals the environment directly funds the social safety net.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you're looking at a 186 country analysis, the very first hurdle isn't environmental at all, it's macroeconomic.
Right, the money part.
Exactly. Before we can even assess the climate impact, we have to figure out the underlying economics of unconditional cash transfers. Like,
Yeah.
what actually happens to a global economy when you just introduce a guaranteed income?
Well, what's fascinating here is the sheer scale and the granularity of the data they've compiled. The researchers didn't just look at one option, they modeled several different scenarios for providing this basic income.
Okay, what kind of scenario?
So, on the lower, more targeted end, they looked at providing a basic income just to the 949 million people living below the poverty line in countries with a low Human Development Index, or HDI.
And just to ground that concept for a second, when we talk about low HDI countries, we're generally talking about nations facing severe systemic challenges.
Yeah, absolutely.
Places with, lower life expectancies, lower per capita income, restricted access to formal education. We're talking about populations that are extremely vulnerable to economic shocks.
Exactly. So that is basically their lower bound scenario. But on the extreme upper end, they modeled a truly universal basic income.
Like for everyone.
Everyone, giving a standard disbursement to the entire global population of 7.7 billion people.
Wow.
And the projected economic impacts are just staggering across the board. Depending on the scale of the rollout, basic income could boost global GDP by anywhere from 0.82% to a massive 38.6%.
Wait, wait. A 38.6% boost to the global GDP?
Yeah, it's a huge number.
That requires a mechanical explanation because capital doesn't just, multiply out of nowhere. Handing someone a dollar doesn't inherently create $2, so there has to be some specific economic engine driving that kind of growth.
Oh, there is. The engine driving that growth is a core economic concept called the marginal propensity to consume, or MPC.
Okay,
Yeah.
MPC.
When you examine populations living below the poverty line, they are what economists classify as liquidity constrained.
Meaning they don't have extra cash lying around.
Practically speaking, yeah. They operate without a financial buffer, they don't have savings accounts, and they're largely locked out of traditional credit markets.
Right.
So when liquidity-constrained households receive an influx of cash, they do not direct it into, like, offshore investments or static savings.
They can't afford to.
Exactly. They spend it almost instantly on immediate survival necessities. Food, basic housing repairs, utilities, medicine, you know, local services.
Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets really interesting. Because you can less visualize this marginal propensity to consume by thinking about how water interacts with different surfaces.
Ooh, I like this.
Yeah, like if you take a gallon of water and you poured it onto a paved concrete driveway, which represents the ultra wealthy who already possess every good and service they need, the water just pools up.
Right. It doesn't really go anywhere.
It just sits there, mostly inactive, and eventually evaporates. It doesn't stimulate any growth.
Mm.
But if you take that exact same gallon of water and pour it into heavily parched dry soil representing those liquidity-constrained households, it's absorbed instantly.
Yeah, it soaks right in.
It feeds the root systems immediately, and suddenly the entire surrounding ecosystem begins to flourish.
That analogy perfectly captures the mechanism of what economists call the fiscal multiplier.
Okay, the fiscal multiplier.
Because that cash is spent immediately on local necessities, it moves rapidly through the local economy. The money changes hands really quickly.
Right, like the grocery store.
Exactly. The grocer sees increased revenue, so they purchase more inventory from local farmers, who then in turn hire more labor to meet that new demand.
So it snowballs?
Yes, the velocity of the money increases, and that stimulates the broader economy at a really foundational level. The study calculates that this velocity creates an extraordinary return on investment.
What kind of ROI are we talking about here?
For every single dollar invested in basic income, it generates between $4 and $7 in downstream economic impact.
$4 to $7. I mean, I imagine an ROI like that makes this incredibly appealing from a macroeconomic standpoint.
Oh, absolutely.
But that still requires sourcing the initial capital. You can't just materialize trillions of dollars to kickstart the fiscal multiplier without triggering severe economic consequences. So we have to talk about the cost.
We do. And the upfront costs are undeniably vast. The study calculates that financing this initiative would range from 0.17% of global GDP, if restricted only to those below the poverty line in low HDI countries, up to 33% of global GDP to cover the whole world.
Yeah, sourcing 33% of global GDP is an astronomical hurdle. But if we focus on the lower bound scenario, just 0.17% of global GDP to effectively eradicate extreme poverty in the most vulnerable nations, that completely shifts the perspective.
It really does. To put that 0.17% into context for you, the study points out that global military expenditures typically range from 1 to 5% of a nation's GDP.
Okay.
And healthcare expenditures consume between 2 and 8%. So, financially speaking, securing that lower end basic income is entirely feasible within the current scope of modern sovereign spending.
The capital is there.
The capital absolutely exists. The real innovation of this paper, however, is where they suggest we source that capital, which brings us to the environmental side of the equation.
Right, because up until this point, we've essentially just been discussing poverty alleviation. How does this massive reallocation of capital actually reduce carbon emissions and plastic waste?
This relies on an economic framework called the double dividend hypothesis.
The double dividend.
Yeah. The underlying principle is that society should heavily tax negative externalities.
And a negative externality is?
It's a cost that a business imposes on society but doesn't actually pay for itself, like air pollution, carbon emissions, or, you know, water contamination. So when a government taxes those harmful activities, they generate this massive new revenue stream that can then be directed toward positive social outcomes. Like a basic income.
Oh, I see.
That is the double dividend. You financially disincentivize environmental destruction while simultaneously funding the eradication of poverty.
That operates exactly like a global swear jar for the planet.
A global swear jar, yeah.
Yeah. Every time a major corporation or industrial sector engages in an activity that degrades the ecosystem, they're forced to put a dollar in the global swear jar.
Yeah.
And that accumulated capital is what directly funds the basic income payouts.
That's the exact mechanism.
But implementing a theoretical swear jar requires highly specific fiscal policies.
Hmm.
What exact mechanisms are the researchers proposing to generate these trillions of dollars?
Well, the paper outlines three highly specific funding mechanisms. The most prominent and honestly the most lucrative is a globally coordinated carbon tax.
Okay, carbon tax, how much?
They calculate that implementing a tax of $50 to $100 per ton of CO2 emissions would generate approximately $2.3 trillion annually.
$2.3 trillion.
Annually. And to contextualize that figure, $2.3 trillion is sufficient to entirely fund a basic income for every single person living below the poverty line across all low and medium HDI countries combined.
Wait, so appropriately pricing the damage caused by carbon emissions alone is enough to build a financial floor for half of the developing world?
Precisely, just from carbon. But they also explore a plastic tax.
Okay.
The researchers modeled a $280 per ton tax levied on common consumer plastics that contain less than 30% recycled content.
So taxing new plastic, basically.
Right. And if implemented just in Europe, this would yield $1.3 billion annually. Crucially, though, by heavily taxing virgin plastic production, it alters the manufacturing incentive structure so drastically that it would cut overall plastic waste generation by nearly a third.
I mean, taxes are notoriously difficult to pass, politically speaking.
Yeah.
No one likes a new tax.
Yeah.
But the data in this paper regarding existing subsidies might be the most compelling argument, because it doesn't require levying a new tax at all. It just requires reallocating capital that governments are already actively spending.
Oh, the subsidy data is truly staggering. The paper cites International Monetary Fund data revealing that the world spent $7 trillion subsidizing the fossil fuel sector in 2022 alone.
$7 trillion.
In 1 year?
In a single year. That is roughly 8% of the entire global GDP.
That is insane.
Right. And it's important to understand how those subsidies work. It's not always direct cash payments to oil companies.
What else is it? It includes artificially suppressing the price of fuel, massive tax exemptions for deep sea exploration, and governments just absorbing the immense healthcare costs associated with air pollution.
So we are proactively using taxpayer money to insulate the very industries driving the climate crisis from the true cost of their operation.
Exactly. We're paying them to do it. And the agricultural sector is similarly distorted.
Really?
Yeah. There are approximately $540 billion in global farm subsidies distributed annually. And the paper notes that nearly 90% of those funds are actively harmful to the environment.
Harmful how?
They incentivize the overapplication of synthetic fertilizers, which causes severe nitrogen runoff and, like, aquatic dead zones.
All right.
They incentivize clearing critical rainforests to expand cattle grazing lands and the overproduction of monocrop commodities.
Wow.
So the researchers argue that if governments simply redirect those existing funds away from environmental destruction, they can fully finance the basic income while simultaneously neutralizing the financial incentives to destroy natural ecosystems.
The elegance of that solution is striking. The capital is already deployed. We just have to point it in a direction that sustains human life rather than degrades it.
Exact.
But this inevitably brings us to the behavioral economics of the proposal. Anytime universal basic income is discussed, the immediate counterarguments center on human behavior.
Always.
Because I would hypothesize that if you inject trillions of dollars into a global economy, landlords might simply absorb the difference by raising rents, and the cost of essential goods could surge.
The inflation argument.
Right. And furthermore, there is this persistent cultural anxiety that unconditional cash destroys the intrinsic motivation to participate in the labor force. Like, won't everyone just quit their jobs and sit on the couch?
Yeah, those are definitely the two dominant critiques. The inevitability of runaway inflation and the lazy myth, you know, the assumption of mass labor force dropout.
So what does the data say?
Fortunately, because the researchers are drawing on decades of empirical data, we don't have to rely on theoretical models. We can look at what actually happens. Let's examine the labor force argument first, utilizing the Alaska Permanent Fund.
Okay, Alaska.
Since 1982, Alaska has distributed an annual unconditional cash dividend to every single resident funded by the state's oil revenues.
Which provides a perfect decades-long case study. Because if the lazy myth holds true, we should see a noticeable suppression in employment figures over that timeline.
But the data reveals the exact opposite. Comprehensive studies on the Alaska dividend demonstrate absolutely zero negative effect on overall employment rates.
Zero.
Zero. And counterintuitively, the dividend actually increased part-time work by 17%.
Wait, it increased work. How does that work?
Well, when you analyze the socioeconomic ripple effects, having that guaranteed financial floor reduced poverty-induced stress, families weren't drowning in immediate debt,
right,
which allowed them the flexibility to have one parent transition to part-time work to manage childcare, or it allowed them to invest the capital into their children's future education.
That perfectly aligns with the marginal propensity to consume concept we discussed earlier.
Exactly.
But Alaska is a unique economy within a highly developed nation.
Hmm.
Does that labor force resilience hold up in an entirely different cultural and economic environment?
It does. And the paper highlights a fascinating national cash transfer program initiated in Iran in 2011 to prove this point.
Michael, what happened in Iran?
Iran executed this massive economic restructuring where they eliminated heavy state subsidies on fuel and bread and replaced them with direct, unconditional cash transfers to citizens.
Was it a lot of money?
It was a substantial payout, amounting to roughly 28% of the median per capita household income at the time.
28%? I mean, that is a significant enough percentage of a household's income to genuinely test if people will choose to stop working.
And again, it did not reduce overall labor force participation. In fact, it generated positive effects on the labor supply of women and self-employed men.
Really? Why self-employed men?
Because these groups suddenly had reliable capital. They could purchase inventory or equipment like sewing machines or raw materials, allowing them to scale small home-based businesses.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. The only demographic where hours worked actively dropped was among men aged 20 to 29.
Which, on the surface, looks like the exact demographic critics worry about. But if they aren't working, what does the data suggest they are doing with that time?
The data indicates they utilize the financial security to delay entering the low-wage labor market, opting instead to enroll in higher education and vocational training.
Ah, so they were going to school.
Right. They were investing in their human capital. And in the long run, a highly educated workforce yields significantly higher economic dividends than a workforce trapped in immediate low-skill survival labor.
So the evidence strongly suggests that people possess an inherent drive to contribute and improve their standing. The basic income simply provides the risk tolerance necessary to make smarter long-term investments.
Exactly. It removes the desperation.
But I have to push back on the inflation variable.
Yeah.
Because I would imagine that injecting trillions into the global economy would naturally trigger severe inflation. I mean, we all experienced the inflation spikes during the pandemic supply chain crises.
Oh, yeah. Painfully so.
If everyone suddenly has more purchasing power, doesn't basic supply and demand dictate that the cost of a loaf of bread will simply skyrocket to consume that new income?
It's a highly valid concern, but it requires a deeper understanding of what we call aggregate purchasing power.
Okay.
Inflation typically accelerates when purchasing power increases without a corresponding ability for the economy to increase the supply of goods and services.
Meaning there's a cap on what can be produced.
Right. If an economy is operating at maximum capacity, like every citizen is employed, every factory line is running 247, and supply chains are totally maxed out, and you introduce more cash, prices will absolutely rise because you have more money chasing the exact same amount of goods.
But the current global economy, particularly in developing nations, is not operating anywhere near maximum capacity. We have massive global underemployment.
Exactly. There is immense slack in the system. There are millions of individuals actively seeking work and vast manufacturing and agricultural sectors operating way below their potential output simply due to a lack of local demand.
When the demand goes up.
When liquidity-constrained individuals receive a basic income and begin purchasing daily necessities, local businesses don't just arbitrarily raise prices. They respond to the new demand by hiring those unemployed workers and expanding their output.
It scale up.
Yes. The studies cited in the paper show that because of this systemic slack, the inflationary effect of a basic income is quite moderate. It usually results in less than a half percentage point increase annually in most modeled scenarios.
And it seems critical to distinguish between printing new fiat currency, which devalues the money supply, and the double dividend mechanism.
Oh, completely.
Because by funding this through a carbon tax or redirecting fossil fuel subsidies, you aren't creating new money out of thin air. You are simply reallocating existing wealth from destructive industries into the hands of consumers.
Precisely. You are shifting capital. You're not expanding the money supply artificially.
But implementing a single unified economic model across 186 completely different sovereign nations cannot be entirely frictionless. To evaluate this objectively, we have to look at the structural limitations. Where does this overarching plan encounter serious friction?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, There is a very real structural limitation that the authors explicitly acknowledge, which we can categorize as the inequality trap.
The inequality trap.
Yeah, in their modeling for a global rollout, the researchers set the basic income payments relative to the national poverty lines of each respective country.
Which introduces an immediate disparity, because the poverty line in a highly developed nation like Switzerland or Norway is drastically higher than the poverty line in a developing nation like Malawi or Haiti.
Exactly. So while a basic income distributed in this manner effectively establishes a survival floor globally, it naturally means that citizens in wealthier nations will receive significantly larger absolute cash payouts than citizens in developing nations.
I see.
Consequently, while extreme life-threatening destitution is eradicated, the broader gap in absolute global wealth between the richest and poorest countries wouldn't necessarily close. In some metrics, it could actually even widen.
That's a critical distinction for you to keep in mind as you evaluate these policies. Universal basic income is highly effective at establishing a foundational floor so that no one falls into complete destitution. But it does not magically solve deeply entrenched global inequality.
No, it doesn't.
Achieving actual parity still requires massive, sustained investments in global infrastructure, equitable trade agreements, and access to advanced education.
It is a foundational tool, not a panacea.
Even if we accept it as a foundational tool, the pure logistics of the operation seem almost insurmountable. I mean, how does a global coalition, physically and securely, distribute monthly cash payments to 7.7 billion people?
It sounds impossible.
Right. Especially when billions live outside traditional banking infrastructures or in regions where local governmental corruption might just intercept the funds.
Well, that logistical nightmare is precisely where modern financial technology has revolutionized the landscape. The paper heavily references the massive success of mobile phone money transfer systems like M-Pesa in Kenya.
Oh, I've heard of M-Pesa.
Yeah, it's amazing. These systems have already achieved widespread adoption across low-income countries, and these platforms completely bypass the need for traditional brick-and-mortar banking infrastructure, allowing capital to be transferred directly to an individual's digital wallet via standard cellular networks.
Which mitigates the risk of the funds being intercepted by corrupt local officials, because the transaction is peer-to-peer from the central fund to the citizen.
Exactly. But what is truly counterintuitive about the logistics is that the universality of a basic income actually makes it significantly easier and cheaper to administer than our current highly targeted welfare systems.
It seems backwards that paying 7.7 billion people would require less administrative overhead than only paying the most vulnerable populations.
I know, but think about the mechanics of targeted welfare. It requires a massive, complex bureaucracy to actively means test citizens.
Right, the paperwork.
It's endless. You have to constantly verify their income, audit their assets, manage complex applications, and continuously police their eligibility.
Yeah.
In nations with low state capacity, that complex gatekeeping creates massive bottlenecks and fertile ground for corruption, because frontline bureaucrats have the power to decide who qualifies.
Furthermore, targeted welfare often creates a poverty trap. If an individual earns $1 over the threshold, they lose their entire suite of benefits, which actively disincentivizes upward mobility.
Exactly. But with a universal basic income, you eliminate the entire bureaucratic maze. Everyone receives the disbursement. Period.
No questions asked.
There are no qualification audits, no asset tests, and no gatekeepers. And on a sociological level, making it entirely universal strips away the social stigma often associated with receiving aid.
That's a great point.
It ceases to be a divisive handout for the poor and becomes a recognized dividend of being a citizen participating in the global economy.
So what does this all mean? When we step back and view this 186 country analysis as a whole, it fundamentally shifts the paradigm of how we approach global crisis management.
It really does.
For decades, the narrative has been framed as a zero-sum game: economic growth versus environmental protection.
Huh.
But this research illustrates that basic income isn't merely a reactive welfare policy designed to bandage the symptoms of poverty. It operates as a highly proactive economic strategy. By taxing environmental destruction, utilizing that global swear jar to fund a universal safety net, society can essentially build a macroeconomic shock absorber. We build intrinsic resilience against future systemic shocks, whether that manifests as the next global pandemic, a massive climate-driven displacement, or the rapid economic displacement caused by artificial intelligence and automation.
It completely rewires the incentive structures of the global economy, aligning the survival of the biosphere with the financial security of the individual. But, and there's always a catch, right?
It's always.
This framework also raises a deeply fascinating paradox, and it's a provocation I want to leave you with to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
The entire brilliance of this double dividend hypothesis relies on aggressively taxing negative externalities, pricing carbon emissions and plastic pollution so high that corporations are forced to abandon them.
Right.
The ultimate goal of those taxes is to discourage the harmful activities until they are entirely eradicated.
So if the taxation functions properly, the targeted behavior eventually drops to zero.
Precisely. So what happens when the policy actually succeeds?
Well,
what happens to the funding apparatus for the global basic income when humanity finally achieves a zero carbon, zero waste, fully sustainable global economy?
The money dries up.
If the global swearer eventually runs dry because industries are no longer polluting, does saving the planet ultimately bankrupt the very social safety net that saved the global population?
Wow.
It forces us to ask. Once we utilize this tool to successfully navigate our way out of the current crisis, what exactly does the next evolution of human economics look like?
That is a phenomenal, slightly terrifying paradox to chew on. You leverage the taxation of environmental destruction to save society, but in doing so, you necessitate the invention of an entirely new economic engine to sustain the utopia you just built. We want to thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems operating around you. Keep looking for those unexpected connections, and we will catch you next time.